All right, so we are going to finish 1 Kings 11.
And then it's all going to get hairy in 1 Kings 12. Because we will be done with Solomon and some less than reputable kings will be coming on the scene. And we'll be dealing with that. And it may or may not remind us of present-day America. Or the world in general, for that matter. All right, so we've got a large section of text here to start out. But we're talking about, obviously, for the last couple of weeks, is the fall of Solomon, how he went from the utmost of heights to the lowest of lows in his idolatry and his chasing after materialistic things. And so thought is, while there's much history and prophecy in this section of Scripture, let us not forget the important lessons that we can learn from Solomon's downfall. And this is what Solomon forgot. Number one, that we have what we have because of God. When we start to give ourselves credit for what we've earned or what we've gotten for ourselves, we start to get in trouble. When we start to forget about the source of our strength and our power and our all the blessings that we have, that gets us off course. The second thing is that God gives and He takes away. So just because He has given you a blessing doesn't mean that if you trample that blessing that He doesn't have the right to take it back. And that's what we're going to see. He must receive the glory for what occurs in our lives. If you claim Christ and you're not giving Him the glory for your life, then you're missing the whole point. That is the whole thing. Are you in Christ? Do you put on Christ? Are you a part of that body or not? And then at no time can our selfish desires come before Him. And that's what happened to Solomon. He put his own desires before God. And like we talked about with the pride last week, isn't that the temptation that we all have, is to put our own desires before not only God, but before others and before everything else. We are inherently selfish people. And so I think there's some lessons to be learned. We may not be kings. We're not Solomon. But we're just as prideful as he is. We're just as selfish as he is. And maybe he can teach us something. People are like, experience is the best teacher. Well, I think other people's experience is the best teacher. Like, I'd rather see other people mess up and then not do it. I don't have to mess up to learn something. I can see other people go, I don't want to do that anymore. That makes perfect sense. Thank you for teaching me that lesson. I think we would do much better if we observed that rather than having to make, don't we just do that? Oh, just go experience things. Now, why? It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Okay, so we met two adversaries of Solomon. Obviously, in this picture, the Steelers are the holy nation of Israel. And the Ravens are the pagan nations that are attacking them. I thought the illustration was very clear. One from the north and one from the south attacked the righteous people of Israel. Work for me. He's going to get out of that tackle, too, and survive and be restored later on. So we meet the two adversaries of Solomon last week, Hadad of Edom, that's coming from the south, and then Rezon of Syria, who's coming from the north. So we've got two foreign powers that are starting to irritate Israel and mess with Solomon and break some of the peace that has been going on for near 40 years under Solomon. So now we get a third adversary, and he's a much more dangerous threat because he's already inside the house. Those two guys are outside. The third threat is going to be from within Israel, and obviously that's going to be a lot more dangerous. If we had a music, it would be dun-dun-dun, That's what would be happening right now. Okay, so let's look at our text. And like I said, it's a fairly lengthy section of text of narrative, but we need to get an understanding of what's going on with this Jeroboam. All right, so starting in verse 26, Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, an Ephraimite from Zerida, a servant of Solomon, whose mother was Zeruah, a widow, also lifted up his hand against the king. So this is a servant of Solomon. He worked for Solomon. He's an Ephraimite. And this was the reason why he lifted up his hand against the king. Solomon built the Millo and closed up the breach of the city of David, his father. The man Jeroboam was very able. And when Solomon saw that the young man was industrious, he gave him charge over all the forced labor of the house of Joseph. And at that time, when Jeroboam went out of Jerusalem, the prophet Ahijah the Shilonite found him on the road. Now, Ahijah had dressed himself in a new garment, and the two of them were alone in the open country. Then Ahijah laid hold of the new garment that was on him and tore it into 12 pieces. And he said to Jeroboam, take for yourself 10 pieces. For thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, behold, I am about to tear the kingdom from the hand of Solomon and will give you 10 tribes. But he shall have 1 tribe for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, the city that I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel. Because they have forsaken me and worship Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemosh, the god of Moab, and Milcom, the god of the Ammonites. And they have not walked in my ways, doing what is right in my sight and keeping my statutes and my rules as David his father did. Nevertheless, I will not take the whole kingdom out of his hand, but I will make him ruler all the days of his life for the sake of David my servant, whom I chose, who kept my commandments and my statutes. But I will take the kingdom out of his son's hand and will give it to you, 10 tribes. Yet to his son I will give 1 tribe, that David my servant may always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem, the city where I have chosen to put my name. And I will take you, and you shall reign over all that your soul desires, and you shall be king over Israel. And if you will listen to all that I command you, and will walk in my ways, and do what is right in my eyes, by keeping my statutes and my commandments, as David my servant did, I will be with you, and will build you a sure house, as I built for David. And I will give Israel to you, and I will afflict the offspring of David because of this, but not forever. Solomon sought therefore to kill Jeroboam, but Jeroboam arose and fled into Egypt. So Shishak, the king of Egypt, and was in Egypt until the death of Solomon. All right. So, again, a lot of narrative. So we meet this guy, Jeroboam. Obviously, his most important enemy because, like I said, he's in Israel. He is an Israelite. He is from the tribe of Ephraim. It's right on his doorstep. He's working in Jerusalem. So he is very much more the threat than the rest of these guys. He's the former superintendent of the forced labor of the house of Joseph, those who have been helping with the construction work in Jerusalem. And there's 2 other relevant items, we've just kind of touched on them, about Jeroboam. One is he's from Ephraim. Now, why does that have any significance? Do you know why that could be a little bit significant in this story? Like, for example, if he was from Judah, that would change the whole story. Because where is Solomon from? He's Judah, right? Okay. So, and who does Solomon have the most support from? Well, his own people, right? Judah is going to support Solomon wholeheartedly. There's very much a coalition there in the south. Well, Ephraim is a northern tribe. And so, if it comes down to a north-south issue, the northern tribes are going to side with Ephraim much more than they're going to side with Judah. And so, what this shows us is that because he's from Ephraim, it gives him a coalition, a power base, a following of people that he can raise up against Solomon. He's got his family, his people that are going to be loyal to him up there in the hill country in Ephraim and beyond as you go farther north. And then the second part is he's a widow's son. So this is not a powerful guy. He's not coming from a super powerful family or anything like that. Now in the Septuagint, they translate this as harlot, which seems like whoever translated the Septuagint wanted to make Solomon look a little bit better and make Jeroboam look a little bit worse. It seems that that's not really the case. It doesn't seem, there's no indication that widow and harlot are the same thing, but that's how it was translated later on. So Jeroboam is not from a disreputable family or anything like that. And God, because if he was, why would God use him necessarily as the one that he's going to raise up? Jeroboam has some good qualities. Okay. Now, here is some historical stuff I can speak to. In 27, it says, and this was the reason why he lifted up his hand against the king. Solomon built the Millo and closed up the breach of the city of David, his father. Now, they had discovered this on the east side over here on the city of David near the Gihon Spring. You can walk down from the city of David and walk around. You can see the stone step structure is what they call it. And that's the Millo. It was to protect the... there from the Jebusite period. It's been there forever. And Solomon built it back up to protect the springs and protect that side of the city of David. And so you can go down there and look. Now, if you go down over here, you kind of see sort of an opening over here. They found... We actually had to go in here with some famous archaeologists. Who was really proud of all his work that he's done over there, over here. And they found what they think is a temple from the Jebusite period down underneath the city of David down there, with a rock that they think was kind of the Holy of Holies sort of thing. Remember when Jacob sets up the rock at Bethel, he just sets up a flat rock.
that's all there is this flat rock, but there's channels for sacrifices and everything else, and it's underneath the city of David that they found all through there. So there's a history of, I guess this is where you would attack if you were going to attack the city of David, because that's where the spring is. And if you can cut off the spring and you can cut off the water supply to the city, you can now seize the city. And so you got to make sure that area is protected, or you're in trouble when somebody comes to siege your city. Okay, so that's what it's talking about when it says Solomon built the Millo. It's this area up here on the east side of the city. Like I said, you can go check that out if you're ever urban. All right, so Jeroboam, he's a younger guy, so he must be pretty impressive because he is put in charge of an entire labor force of the house of Joseph. Now, when we say the house of Joseph, what do we mean? Who is the house of Joseph?
Ephraim and Manasseh.
Ephraim and Manasseh, right. Okay, so here's not a great picture there, but here's the tribe of Ephraim here. Manasseh covers those two regions right there. So this is the house of Joseph. Anybody that lives in these areas would be the house of Joseph. And so you can see Shiloh is in Ephraimite territory. Joseph was an Ephraimite. Joshua was an Ephraimite. That's why they put the tabernacle in Shiloh. So Ephraim has played a pretty good role in all this, but it kind of becomes the main tribe of the north. They're and sometimes you'll hear that all of Israel called the Ephraim sometimes. It is representative of the whole north. They're kind of the figurehead like Judah is in the south. So he's over all those people in those sections of land. All right, now if we go back here to 2 Samuel 5, remember this, David had set up his capital in Hebron. Remember that when he first started his first 7 years as king, all of Israel does not recognize David as king because he's a little too Judah. He's a little too southern. And Saul was a Benjamite, and they're not willing to necessarily go all the way down there. So that's why, remember, David moves his capital from Hebron to Jerusalem, because he's giving up some Judah there. You know, Hebron is very much a southern city. Jerusalem's in Benjamin. It's more centrally located. It's a concession. Obviously, they want that city, but that's one of the political reasons why he moves it up there. So, if you remember this from 2 Samuel, it says, "Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, 'Behold, we are your bone and flesh. In times past, when Saul was king over us, it was you who led out and brought in Israel. And the Lord said to you, "You shall be shepherd of my people Israel, and you shall be prince over Israel.'" So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them at Hebron before the Lord, and they anointed David king over Israel. David was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned 40 years. At Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and at Jerusalem, he reigned over all Israel and Judah for 33 years. So you can see there's been some political tension in the past between north and south. They haven't always gotten along. There's always been some a little bit here and there. David is the one that brought them together. Solomon has kept them together, and now it's getting a little bit tenuous again. They're starting to split back apart again as Solomon nears his death. Okay. So Jeroboam's ties to the house of Joseph is going to become significant when the rebellion starts to happen, because he's got a built-in group of people that are going to follow him. He's got the Ephraimites, and he's got the north that is going to automatically go to his side when it comes down to this, especially when Rehoboam, in chapter 12, doesn't listen to his elders and decides to be harder than Solomon was and tax more and all that, and they get irritated and they're going to go with Jeroboam. So, ironically here, you see what happens in this chapter. Again, sovereign God, his will being accomplished. Solomon basically chooses, promotes, and gives a power base to the man that's ultimately going to overthrow the kingdom. You know, he's the one that put him in power. This guy, Solomon's impressed with him. He promotes him. He puts him in power, and he puts him in a place where this guy can get a following. And that's what's going to end up splitting the kingdom. And so now we have God acting decisively to inform Jeroboam that one day he's going to have his own kingdom. Jeroboam's not doing this on his own accord. He's going to get a prophecy from a prophet, from God, that says this is what's going to happen. Okay? And Ahijah meets him out on the road with this new cloak, and tears it into 12 pieces and says, "You take 10 of them. And that's going to be your section of the kingdom." All right, let's compare a couple of verses here. We saw that what we just read in 1 Kings 11 with Ahijah tearing the garment into 12 pieces. If you remember back in 1 Samuel 15, when Samuel takes the kingdom from Saul, look at what it says. As Samuel turned to go away, Saul sees the skirt of his robe and it tore.
And Samuel said to him, "The Lord has torn the kingdom of Israel from you this day and has given it to a neighbor of yours who is better than you. Over here, behold, I'm about to tear the kingdom from the hand of Solomon and will give you 10 tribes.
It's a parallel here. We've got two garments being torn to symbolize the kingdom being torn in two. And I'm going to give it to somebody better than you. I'm going to give it to somebody else. So Saul and Solomon have a little bit of a parallel. And that's not a parallel you want if you're Solomon. You're supposed to be like your father, not like Saul. But he's become very much like that. So in both passages, an outer garment is torn as a symbol of the fact that God is tearing the kingdom away from the reigning king. The garment here is divided into 12 pieces, of which 10, symbolizing 10 northern tribes, are given to Jeroboam. Now, if you're like me, you read this and you're like, all right, 2 tribes. What is that? How come it says he only has, how come it says that he has control of 10, and it keeps saying that Solomon's going to have one tribe? Aren't there 2 left because we've got 12 tribes? Well, there's 2 options on this. Again, maybe this is boring to you, but you decide. One of the commentaries I read said 1 tribe is to remain for the sake of David and Jerusalem. That's Judah. Benjamin is not included in the map here, perhaps because this tribe was regarded simply as Jerusalem's own territory. On the analogy of the Canaanite city-state, this territory came with the city and needed no special mention. Or it's assumed that he's already going to be in charge of Judah, and so he's given Benjamin as that 1 tribe that he will still be over. Does it matter? I don't know that it does. If you're worried about, you know, if you're like me, you read that and you go, why does it say 11 when there's 12? There's something there. Either you've already got Judah or you're not counting Benjamin because Benjamin is Jerusalem and it's just part of the deal. Because really it's interesting because Benjamin and Judah have not always gotten along. The Benjamites have not always been the greatest people. There's been some issues with Benjamites, just if you read back to the Old Testament. There's always been some issues with the Benjamites getting on board with some other things. So, there you go. And Saul was a Benjamite, so that kind of tells you a little bit there. All right. So, Ahijah has 2 important theological ideas here. Number one, it's only because of God's faithfulness to David and sovereign choice of Jerusalem that Judah will continue as a kingdom. Not because he owes Solomon anything. Not because of anything Solomon's done, but because I made a promise. I promised that David would have a king on the throne. I promised Jerusalem would be my holy city. So they're going to be sustained. And number 2, the division will occur as a judgment of Solomon and the people's idolatry, which is exactly what Solomon prayed back in, I believe, chapter 4. You know, when we do this, this is what you're going to do. You're going to split our kingdom. You're going to send us to exile. He predicts all this stuff in his prayers, and he asks for ability to repent. So my thought in a modern-day idea here is that clearly sin impacts a country's secular and political existence. So if you allow sin to take root in a country, obviously we suffer spiritually from that perspective, but your political base is going to suffer. Your secular existence is going to suffer. And just look at America's place in the world and what has happened over the last, I don't know, 25 or 30 years. And the proliferation of that sin, acceptance of that sinful lifestyle into the culture. And I think it has reflected accurately. We've allowed sin to take control, not just tolerate sin, but to promote sin. I mean, think about the course of this whole gay marriage argument. I heard a quote from a guy, it's probably a 20-year-old quote, but he said in his lifetime he had gone from seeing homosexuality be a crime to be something that was frowned upon, to be something that was tolerated, to now something that is promoted. I mean, he's seen it run the whole gamut. Like, you used to be able to be arrested for it, and now we're celebrating it like it's the most awesome thing in the world. There's not a whole lot of things that we've done that with, that were once a crime, that are now is the celebration of what we're moving towards as a country. I saw all kinds of stuff online the last few days because I guess Ireland voted to support gay marriage. So it's just a matter of time. Just so we know, it doesn't matter to us in our spiritual sense, but it's just a matter of time before this country keeps going in that direction.
That was just 23 years ago. They said that it was a crime in Ireland.
You know, really, in Ireland? Yeah.
In another 23 years, it'll be a crime for you to have brought this whole thing.
Actually, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. That's I totally agree with you. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I remember, if you're a literature person, if you've ever read any Oscar Wilde, Oscar Wilde was arrested in the 1880s, 1890s for homosexuality. He served a jail term for it. So that's how far we've come in 100 years. No. And if you've ever read The Portrait of Dorian Gray, you see it. I like the book, but you're like, ooh, that's an uncomfortable thing to read. There's some, the way he describes Dorian is a little bit uncomfortable sometimes. Yeah.
It brings to mind Psalm 12:8 that says, the wicked freely strut about, but what is vile is honored among men.
Yeah.
Yes. Amen.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, and we shouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
You know, we really shouldn't be surprised. Yeah, it's going to get worse before it gets better, right?
So we know equal wins the battle.
Exactly, yeah. That's the comfort of this whole thing.
Yeah, good thing you're at the end of the book, huh?
Yeah. It's good, yeah. Yeah, you're one of those people that skips to the end when you read a novel. All right, so if you remember the parallels with chapter 11, in verse 13 it says, however, I will not tear away all the kingdom, but I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of David, my servant, for the sake of Jerusalem that I have chosen. And then at the end, in 35 and 36, God says the same thing through Ahijah. I will take the kingdom out of his son's hand and will give it to you, 10 tribes. Yet to his son I will give one tribe, that David, my servant, may always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem, the city where I've chosen to put my name. So remember, we talked about that with Jerusalem. And Jerusalem was chosen. It was to make God's name famous. And the Davidic covenant was that God will always have a son of David on the throne there. So again, this impacts the end of the book, because there will be a son of David sitting on the throne in Jerusalem again, in the literal Jerusalem. And all this will come to fulfillment. Okay, so 11:13 is repeated here in a slightly different way. Solomon will lose no tribes during his lifetime, and his son is to have one tribe, so the Davidic flame will always burn. In fact, although Jeroboam has been promised that he can also have a dynasty like David's if he is obedient, this promise already conceals within it the expectation of failure. You know, if you'll just do this, you'll have a kingdom too, but I know you're not going to do it. You see this several times. Joshua says this to Moses, says it. Kind of tells him, you know, you're going to go in this land and you're going to get tripped up and you're going to do this. And you say you're going to be holy, and the people are like, no, we'll follow God. And he says, no, you're not. You're going to fall away because you're selfish. You know, you chase after these idols. And so it's the same thing. The division of the kingdom is not going to be forever. One day it will come back together again. But we know, if you know the history of the northern kingdom, not many good kings up there. In fact, zero. So they never quite get it. The south barely gets it. The north never gets it. So Ahijah continues by commenting further on Jerusalem's importance to Judah's survival. Not only has God chosen David, the Lord has chosen Jerusalem. His purpose there was to glorify his name through unified and committed worship at the temple and through the witness of a people wholly committed to a relational, just, and covenant God. So even though the kingdom's going to be split, God doesn't say, hey, go build your own temple up there. This is still God's house. It is still where Yahweh will live. And one of the problems the north is going to have is they're going to want to build their own temple because they don't want to go down to Jerusalem because, you know, they might stay down there. They might like the south better than what we have it up here. They build shrines. We'll see that in a few chapters. In Dan and Bethel, high places. And they're going to, if you remember when Jesus talks to the Samaritan woman, he asks, they're talking about the temple, and she says, we've got one right here. We say we go up here. You know, you say you have to go to Jerusalem. Which one's the house of God? So Samaritans have a temple of sorts already up there. So that's going to be a problem with the north. The north is going to fall to idolatry very, very quickly because of their jealousy of the south and the fact that the temple remains there. As to Jeroboam, God promises him a kingdom and, surprisingly, a sure house. He says, I'll build you a sure house if you'll follow my commandments. And, of course, it's not going to take long for that to fall away. So only then is he going to be blessed as David has been blessed. Remember, we've hit this several times. The covenant is with David. The covenant has never been with anybody but David. So if you will walk as David did, you will have blessings. And, unfortunately, nobody else wants to walk the way David did, at least not in his entirety. And I think it tells you a lot about David in the sense of, it's not like we read the scriptures and we think David was perfect, but it must tell you a lot about David's heart and how he always ran back to God. I think that's the big difference between David and Saul. I mean, if we're listing sins, we probably find a lot more David sins than we do Saul sins, but look at the reaction after the sins. You know, Saul's the, you know, every time Saul gets called out on a sin, it's, yeah, but, you yeah, know, but, he's yeah. that guy. You know, it's why I always tell my my players and stuff when you come on the floor. If I tell you the stupidest thing you've ever heard, like you don't even know what I'm talking about, just say yes, sir, and go down to the end of the bench because you're going back in the game in like 2 minutes. As soon as you go, yeah, but, okay, now you're done. know, you don't have the heart I need right now, so you need to go sit at the end of the bench. You know, you have to learn your lesson now. It is being able to respect who and submit to the authority that's there. Now, I'm not saying I'm God or anything. Don't get that wrong. But in a microcosm, that's the idea. So what is clear in these promises is that any idolatry group will bring a covenant to a halt. So as soon as you bring other gods into this equation, deal's off. You know, he says, I'm a jealous God and I'm not sharing glory, and you're not bringing other gods into this equation. So as soon as you want to start delving into idolatry, contract's canceled. Yeah, there's language in the contract that prohibits idolatry, and God is going to take that very seriously. So Jeroboam is supposed to emulate David, not Solomon. Don't be like him, be like his dad. He was supposed to emulate his dad, and he's not doing it. Don't follow him, follow his dad. It's kind of that same idea when people want to emulate and kind of lionize Christians sometimes. It's like, don't follow that person. Follow the person he's supposed to be following. You know, follow the Savior, not the, you know, because he's going to disappoint you. No matter how great he is or she is, we screw up. We say stupid things. We do stupid things. We're going to disappoint you. Don't follow me. Follow the Savior. And so look farther up the chain. I'm not what it's all about. It's got to be something else. So Isaac concludes the message by stating that all these things happen to afflict the offspring of David, not to eliminate the promise of an eternal kingdom. So it's a punishment. It's a judgment. This is what's going to happen because of what they've done. So it says Solomon sought therefore to kill Jeroboam. Sounds very Saul-like, doesn't it? As soon as David rose up, what did Saul try to do every day? Try to kill David. Same idea here. Jeroboam arose and fled to Egypt to Shishak, the king of Egypt, and it was in Egypt until the death of Solomon. So the episode ends with Jeroboam fleeing to Egypt to avoid Solomon's desire to kill him. And what we find here is he finds refuge in Shishak's court. There's been a change of leadership in Egypt. The previous pharaoh was buddy-buddy with Solomon. The new one, he doesn't really care about Solomon as much, and he's willing to provide refuge to an opponent of Solomon. So the political dynamic, the peace dynamic that was going on between Egypt and Israel is about to go away. And so it's a different climate now, and Solomon is going to go away. So perhaps the new pharaoh resents paying Solomon's tolls, or perhaps he attempts to, to build a new power base that will serve his own interests. Either way, the Davidic lineage is in trouble because Jeroboam has a constituency in Israel, he has a significant foreign ally in Egypt, and he has God's promise to place him in power. I mean, like, could it get any better than that? I mean, if you wanted assurance that you were going to win, I got backing in Israel, I got backing from Egypt, and God told me I was going to get the kingdom. I'd be pretty confident, too, at that point.
Hey, so, what was winning today?
Never have one of those days.
Yeah, I got to get bigger pictures. Where you just ever have one of those days where you just can't win. That's not. Yeah. So, here's the important part about Ahijah. As a prophet, Ahijah ushers in this kind of prophetic age in the Old Testament. And prophets are going to become very important with Elijah and Elisha, and then obviously with all our prophets. Now, had there been prophets before? Sure there were. But they become the primary message givers for the next several hundred years in history. You know, from now until Malachi, the prophets are who speak for God. And we're going to see that very clearly throughout these years. You know, we've had Samuel, we've had Nathan, we've had the prophets before, but never before have these prophets, they become God's spokespersons, they're anointers of new kings, they're miracle workers, and they're Israel's overall conscience. You know, when the kings are doing bad, the prophets show up and say, hey, you're breaking God's commandments, he's going to judge you. And that's why the kings don't really like the prophets too much, because they never come with good news. You know, the prophet never comes to give you a pump you up. He's always telling you what's going on. Yeah, so much so that they don't even want to go, why do I have to go talk to the king again? He hates it when I come and talk to him. All right, and then we end with the death of Solomon, and this sets up the death formula of the books of the kings. It says, now the rest of the acts of Solomon and all that he did in his wisdom, are they not written in the book of the acts of Solomon? And the time that Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over all Israel was 40 years. And Solomon slept with his fathers and was buried in the city of David, his father, and Rehoboam, his son, reigned in his place. So that we get this, he slept with his fathers. You can't see this picture very well. I thought that would be a little bit better. But this is a first, or an Old Testament tomb that they've unearthed in Jerusalem. It's southwest of the city. It's called Ketef Hinnom. I actually got to visit this place. But you can see that hole right there. That's the bone repository. That's where, so you have places up here, you see these little holes? Those are head holes.
So you would put a body here, body here, body here, body here. Big tomb.
So we're talking about a rich family. Whoever had this tomb was a really rich family.
You'd lay the body there. It would stay there for a year. Then the eldest son would come into the tomb, gather up the bones, put them in the bone repository, just like the fathers before him. Yeah, wouldn't you like to have that job? And he literally slept with his fathers. His bones were in the same repository as his fathers. And that's how you can tell if it's an Old Testament tomb or a New Testament tomb. Old Testament tombs have bone repositories. New Testament tombs have the bone boxes, the ossuaries.
That was just for one at a time, though.
Yes. Yeah. So, and they would have shelves for the ossuaries instead of these big bone pits underneath. And so, to give you an idea, I got a picture from our trip there. These are some people that I was on the trip with. But that's how they would have laid them out. Bone repositories back underneath here. And so these bodies would have laid here for a year. And then they would come in a year later, gather up the bones, toss them in the pit. Yeah, so they were just clearing a part of the lower of the city, and they found this tomb, and they found all kinds of relics and everything else. Because it seems like when they would put the bodies in here, they wouldn't remove jewelry or anything like that. So they found all kinds of coins, and there was an inscription. It's the oldest inscription they found. It's got the Shema on it from like the 7th century BC. I mean, it's just amazing stuff that they found. Really rich place there southwest of the city. If you turn this way from there, you can see the city walls right there. I mean, it's just right across the valley of the Hinnom Valley. So,
was it a structure or was it simply just
a layout? It was covered just with, you know, fill dirt and things like that. And so they were clearing off a hillside to build something, and it happens all the time. Oh, here's a tomb, you know. There's just stuff everywhere in Israel. So here's the death formula that you see, the author's source material, the book of the Acts of Solomon, which we don't have, but that's where you can find a lot more information if that ever turns up. Then the link of Solomon's reign, and then Solomon's death successor are mentioned. So, yeah, poor Mufasa. And so every time somebody dies in Kings, it tells you, you can find where they're, this is where you can read more about them, this is how long they reigned, and this is who replaced them. And we're going to see that over and over again. As we go through the next few minutes. So, let's finish up here. Let's remember the good things about Solomon. He was an organizational genius. He implemented great foreign policy. He was humble enough to ask for God's help. He's thoughtful enough to pray for Israel and the foreigners as well. And his wisdom was unmatched in spiritual matters. But at the same time, his ambition was to be the greatest king overtook him. His love for gold and precious things became out of control. His love for foreign women doomed him to idolatry. And not only did he tolerate it, but he practiced idolatry as well. So despite his wisdom, Solomon could be irrational, ungrateful, and even foolish. And so there's probably a lesson there for us as we get on our high horses sometimes, that even the most devoted folks can get a little bit off track sometimes if they get too caught up in themselves. Okay, so next week we will see this kingdom fall apart with Jeroboam and Rehoboam. So the real drama starts next week. All right, let me close this in prayer. Yeah, go ahead.
My computer crashed, and she had to order a new one that hasn't even shipped yet. So I'm unable to get it to 10 days to the snack list.